Welcome to Launch and Learn. This is our first episode, so we are super excited about it. Woohoo! In this podcast, we talk to entrepreneurs about their experiences in launching startups. This podcast is hosted by Matthias Dickerhof and myself, Alexander Thompson. In today's episode, we will hear from Timo Hahn, who will talk about his previous company, Wider, which was like Tinder for buying art, creating an art marketplace for buyers and artists. Timo will take us through his journey from validating the idea, building the first product, and acquiring customers. So welcome, Timo, to the podcast.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Matthias. Great to be here.
Yeah, good to have
Great
you.
Great to have you, yeah. So what are you having for lunch today?
I have a pad thai. So big fan of Thailand. My wife is from Thailand. Love the people, love the food. So pad thai it is.
Very nice. So before we dig into the details, it would be great so you sort of could tell us about yourself and your background.
Sure. Yeah, so as you mentioned, Timo Hahn, my name. I'm German by birth, but I moved to Switzerland many years ago, 12, 13 years ago, and started my startup here. That's what I will talk about today. And so for a startup founder, I guess I have a rather unconventional background. I used to study computer science, spent over 10 years in the financial institutions. Never been very happy with these jobs. I was always trying to get more responsibility to do more. And also resulted in my application for an MBA program. I was just trying to expand my world and moving forward. And the MBA program was rather a traditional program, but we had a big focus on applied innovation with a fantastic professor. And he really taught us to think like an entrepreneur, to start with experiments, to come up with startup ideas. And that program really got the entrepreneur out of me. I think the entrepreneur has always been inside of me, otherwise you can't get it out. Already as a child, you know, I started to selling these, how they're called, leaflets, the advertising brochures, which you usually get for free. I found a big package somewhere in the forest and I started selling them to older people. My mom wasn't very happy at that time and then she forbade me to continue doing that. But for that Saturday morning, I made quite some money for 8-year-old back then. Yeah, and that's how I got hooked with the startup ideas and to continue with university assignments and really push them forward as a startup idea.
Yeah, so you're working in like financial services for a long time, I noticed.
Yeah.
What was the turning point for you to say, okay, I've had enough of this, I need to go, you know, quit and do an MBA program?
Yeah, probably it was the boardroom. You know, people say, yeah, that of course you need to be happy in that career. I wasn't. So that's why I was always looking for new projects, new responsibility. And then there was the financial crisis as well. So it was difficult to find new projects to move within the company. So I thought if I don't get the chance internally, I look for the challenge externally, which was for me that turning point to look for an MBA program. It was really just to, you know, keep me entertained and to do something, to learn something. And of course, I was hoping for, you know, getting a different mindset, but also making a boost in my career. That boost in career didn't happen. I started my startup. So it happened on a very different level. But looking back, this was the best decision I made.
You came up with the idea for Wider in this pitch competition at your executive MBA program, correct?
Yeah, yes, correct.
I'm always curious to hear, like, did this idea come out of a passion that you had for the industry, or was it more of an opportunity you saw, or how did that initial idea come to fruition?
Yeah, so initially it was rather a boring process because it was part of that university assignment. So we were a study group of six people, and the six of us were supposed to collect 50 startup ideas. So when you walk through the city, you know, keep your eyes open, you look at what people are doing and what they're not doing, mixing that with trends, what's happening in the world, and there are startup ideas everywhere. So part of that university assignment was to collect them. So with the six people in the team, 50 ideas each, we had 300 ideas, and we just mixed and, you know, merged them. Some of them were pretty useless, of course. Some of them were, you know, too far science fiction, but some of them sounded quite feasible, and we saw some market opportunity. At the end, we nailed it down to three ideas, and that Wider idea was one of them. And we started with user interviews, with experiments, just to see for which of the three we have the best chances. And Wider was the one to survive. And we took it out of that university assignment and really used it in the real world. And I think that's how it really started. Otherwise, it would have been an assignment as it is for most other people. But we started to do interviews. We went to an IKEA, spent a Saturday morning, and were observing people how they bought posters. And I'm not sure if it's still the case at IKEA, but they were like all hanging on a wall where you flip through. And during that flipping through, people, you know, they stopped suddenly. They looked at a poster, they flipped forward, they looked at other ones, they went back, they put their partner to the side. And that's where the idea came from. So Wider is a marketplace for artists and for art lovers, but was known as the Tinder for art. And that's exactly where that idea came from. So spending a Saturday morning at IKEA observing people, and that's how we moved that forward.
So how long was sort of the timeline to get to that point to say like, hey, you know, Wider is a good idea, let's move forward with this? Like, was it over a 3 months period or?
Yeah, so when we started, we are two founders, Matthias and myself, different Matthias, not you. And we both had still our full-time jobs. We were still busy with the MBA. I just started a family. So it was just a side project at the beginning. And then going forward with the validation, we had customers, you know, we had bigger interest. Then over, let me think back, it was 5 months maybe. That's when we really knew it's time to continue full time. We always knew that, you know, it would be stupid to quit jobs and to, you know, cut everything and just run with the startup idea. But we also knew once we have some sort of validation, we need to do that, because otherwise it remains a hobby project, a weekend project, which it was not supposed to be. So we knew, okay, there is some turning point, and from this point onwards, we have to, you know, give 100% and nothing else.
What was the process for you for building the first version of the product? Did you guys build it yourselves? Did you outsource it? Did you start with prototypes? Like, start with how did you do the early stages?
Yeah, so we started with prototypes. After being at IKEA and observing the people flipping through these posters, I went to Google and Googled paintings and on the picture search, and I printed out the first 50 results. And I gave it to people. So imagine that's an iPhone now. Imagine that's a Tinder for art. That's relatively easy to imagine. And I made them flip through these printouts. I talked with them. When was the last time you bought either art or posters? How did it feel like? What problems did you have? What went smooth? What would you change? And then, of course, also, you know, the emotions they have when flipping through these paintings. And I did that with a lot of people, those that are interested in art and paintings, those that have no interest at all, and try to understand what flipping through paintings does with them over the process. So that was our first prototype. We then went on with some mockups just to see how the app could look like. We had a web app. There was no database or anything behind it. It used my private PayPal account as a checkout option, but that's what we did first. And that way we were able to continue on that idea of Tinder for art. We had a few dozen users on it. We started with 56 paintings, which we collected over that course, and already had a very first, I wouldn't call it MVP, more like a prototype, that we saw how people go along. And once we really figured out that this is working, people are interested in it, that's when we went to an agency. Because even though I used to study computer science, I can't program, definitely not a real app. So we went to an agency and they helped us to design the whole app and also to launch it.
Regarding launching your MVP, I mean, did you have some steps there? For example, you know, you started first launching on iOS, or you launched first on Android, or was that depending on your target market, or what were sort of some factors that you were thinking about?
Yeah, so we launched on iOS first. So it was 2015, and that's when iOS was still stronger than Android. I think in the meantime, it switched. But also that our user group, when we look at the male about 30 years old and female about 40, 45 years old, they are rather the users of iPhone devices than Android devices. Mm-hmm. Also, our users, not only age group, but also they lived in larger cities, they were better educated, and all that pointed us to more usage of iPhones. Also, it's not my research, but they say that iPhone users are more open to spend money online than Android users on app store already, but also when you buy something. So that made us the decision easy to go with iOS first. But yeah, we quickly introduced Android as well, because Android was more used for artists. Right? So we quickly found out that artists, at least our artists, they are more on the Android devices. That's why we also quickly after the iOS device launched with Android as well.
And you also had a web version as well, right? I was reading, yes. You have you actually got a higher sales average on your web version than your mobile. At what point did you launch that one?
That was also at the beginning. Well, we had it more as a landing page to reference to the apps. But then we always got more questions about, can't you have a web page as well? Because I like the paintings, but they're really small on such a small device. And back then, the Android and iPhones, they were smaller than they are today. So that's why a lot of customers ask us if you can have a web version as well. So that's why we started it. It was probably 6-8 months after we launched with the apps. And it's true, we had a higher shopping cart value on the website. So we saw a lot of paintings, like the sales of the paintings in the apps, they were up to €250. While on the website, it was 250 to 2,500, 3,000. So there was really a difference on the shopping cart value.
I think that's also quite interesting. I mean, what was the reason you chose app first over web? For example, web usually is faster to build compared to native applications. So what sort of brought you to that?
Yeah, it was for us to differentiate from the competition. Right? There are a lot of, already back then, but also today, there are a few web shops. They sell art online, but you can't really feel the art, right? Is it a poster? Is it a painting? What is it? It just looks all the same. And that's why our approach was more the Tinder for art. So of course the tagline worked for us to attract new customers. But it also visualized, Tinder is more for casual dating. That's what we did, casual art, not the fine art, not the elite partner of these worlds, but really making art accessible for everybody. And that's why we started with apps first, really to differentiate it from the competitors and having that tagline work as a value proposition for our users.
So yeah, part of the difficulty with this two-sided market is you have to deal with the artists as well as the consumers. Like you can't just... I don't know, you have to get the approval of the artist to put their art on the app, I would imagine. How did you deal with that tension between, how to build both sides at the same time?
Yeah, true. It's challenging enough to build one customer, but it's even a bigger challenge to build both of them, both sides. And there's always the chicken and egg problem. So which side do you start with? And we decided to start with the artist because out of several reasons. So some of our mentors, they told us, even if the idea flies, there are not enough artists out there to produce enough art. So that's why we focused on it. And also no artists means no paintings. No paintings means no users, of course. So that's why we started with the artist side and build a good product for the artist. So we were in close contact. We had 10, 12 artists, friends. We worked together with them to evaluate the idea, to see what they need, how can we simplify it, how can we separate from the competition, can be better. So that's how we got along. At the end, it also helped us because the artist had more patience. Right? If you come as a user into a Tinder for art and you only have 5 paintings, so you swipe 5 times, then the database is empty, you would not come back. Right? But as an artist, if you give us a painting and nothing happens for a few weeks or even month, you wouldn't even realize, because that's exactly what's happening on all the other platforms. So they are more patient and forgiveful, which helped us at the beginning to really build the product they needed.
Mm-hmm. How did you decide and what were the channels you used to find and get these artists? Like you just went on the street to get them, or you had some sort of methodology to get there?
From early on, we built a Facebook page and were trying to get the word out. Also to share with artists, to get in contact with them. And also to build some sort of fan base, right? So of course, Facebook likes, they don't pay my salary and my rent, but it's a very, very early indication of some sort of direction. And later on, we went to a lot of like art universities, we went to art fairs just to get the word out. And we quickly realized that our artists at the beginning, they were more from the eastern part of Europe. That's why when we launched the app, it was in English only, it was international from day one. Because we figured out that the artists in our home market, they are not very interested in such a platform, be it because of reputation or many other reasons. But those artists in the eastern or even in the southern part of Europe, they were very interested. So we quickly, once we launched the product, we quickly built an artist's user base and they submitted artworks. Also, I think because we focused on the artists from very early on, we really built a product that was easy for them to use, where they saw the value on using it. Then over time, we got artists from everywhere, also from Switzerland again, from Germany, which is our home markets, but then also from the UK. The US grew quite quickly. We also got good promotion and PRs that Tinder for Art really resonated with magazines and media outlets. So they helped us to get the word out. Then artists was the easy part to recruit.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you said a lot of the attraction to your app was through Facebook ads. How did you target those specifically to people who you think would be more prone to buying art online?
Yeah, that was one of our experiments at the very beginning. So we had a few Facebook ads for artists and for users, and we spent $5 per day with different cities. So we tried to have one advertisement for artists, one for users, and we did them in Madrid, in London, in Zurich, in Berlin, in Moscow, you know, just to see where we get better responses for users and for artists. And that also allowed us to, you know, focus on one of the points. So I mentioned before that the artists came more from Eastern and Southern part of Europe, and that was exactly because of these advertisements. So that's how we reach out to the artists. And from these Facebook campaigns, we quickly realized that our artists, at the very beginning at least, come more from Eastern and Southern part of Europe, while users and buyers come more from Middle and Northern part of Europe. And yeah, with the advertisements, that worked out quite well.
So it was mostly location-based. You didn't find any difference between the age or other demographics?
That as well, absolutely. We found out that the age of our users and buyers is more, like we were trying to find the customer with these advertisements as well. Mm-hmm. So from the very beginning, we assumed that the age group is more like male in their like late 20s, early 30s, because that's when you have your first job, that's when you have your first apartment, that's the first time you invest money in something. And also female around 40 to 50, because also they have like a better taste than some men have. They want to have more decoration in their home. And that's more the typical like buyer of some nice stuff for your home, right? So not about art, because we were like decorating your home. And both of them worked out well. That was validated during these advertisements and also later on. But we had two more target groups. One is female in the late 20s, early 30s, so same like guys. I think that, you know, even if you're a guy, you wouldn't make the final decision what's in your home. So if you're in a first relationship and you live together with your girlfriend, boyfriend, usually the girl is the one to make the buying decision. So that's what we saw on the platform that worked on the advertisement, but also the user signups. And we had a lot of guys in their like middle of 50s to sign up. Of course, there's a lot of speculations, midlife crisis, divorce. I don't know what the trigger was, but that also worked out as a fourth user group. And the Facebook ads, they helped us to find that user group, which we then validated with quantitative data being on signups, being on Google Analytics, whatever we found out as well.
Cool.
So I saw, yeah, you guys got a lot of traction, a lot of media attention. You got a TechCrunch article, things like this. How did you scale your team effectively when you were working with an agency? Like, what was your involvement with them in scaling the application further once you start getting more traction?
Yeah, that was mainly needed on the database because a lot of traction means a lot of traffic, and all these pictures, they have a few megabytes. So the database needed to be very fast, but that was the only requirement. Mm-hmm. Everything else was set up from the beginning, and it was not really difficult to scale up. Once we had that product in place, of course, with the prototypes, it was a different story. But once we had that first product out there, it was easy to work with the agency. Also, it helped that I had an IT background. So even though I cannot code, but I do understand, you know, quite a lot about programming and being some sort of product manager. So that helped to get the team aligned. And the scaling was also easy because we also looked at automating stuff. So at the beginning, we did everything manually because we never knew what is working and what isn't. Yeah, so everything was done manually. But once we got traction, we quickly realized that we can't continue doing that manually. So we worked on automating stuff. Either with tools like Zapier, or I had a virtual assistant who helped me doing that so that I can focus on automation again. So we had a very small team, even though we had a few 100,000 users on the platform. We were still a very small team to handle all that.
Reflecting on this, would you have done it differently? Like, would you choose an agency today as well? Or would you have chosen, let's say, doing an in-house or doing another method of building this?
I think it's always better to do it in-house because it was also difficult for us to find an agency. So we talked with 80, 90 different agencies, from freelancers to big companies and everything in between, from Europe to East Europe to India to the Philippines. And it was really tough to find somebody who understands the way we are working, who really delivers something new, like a real new product and not just a second prototype. And we found that with that one agency. There were two people and they just clicked with us, and that's how it worked. So even though it was an agency, we had a relationship like we would have with an internal one. And that's why it worked. And I wouldn't change it because of the setup we had. We were quite lucky with that. Ideally, you do it yourself or you have somebody internal to do it. But I understand that's not always possible, also in our case.
As a startup founder, you know, you have limited capital, you have limited resources, and you have limited time. How do you make sure that you really focus on the most, let's say, critical things at any given time?
Yeah, that's really difficult. Because as a startup founder, you have to do everything from the stuff you like to do to that you don't like to do, and even the stuff you don't even know that you should be doing it. And it's time, it's money you invest in it. And then that was also learning we had to go through. So coming from a bank, money was never the problem in my project. Now it was. And then we were looking at a lot of experiments. So we were always trying to find the cheapest version of what we can build or test to get the biggest learning out of it. And we challenged ourselves that none of these experiments should cost more than $50, and didn't always work, but that was like our guideline. So up to $50, it's a good experiment. Afterwards, you know, you have to really understand why you want to spend more money than that. And of course, you can also convert it in time. So if you can do the experiments in a certain time, it's worth it. If it takes too much, then not. Because I think focus is also one of the skills of any startup founder. There's so much distraction out there. There is so much to do, and the day is only, you know, you only have 24 hours and you still have to sleep. So you really have to focus on what you want to get out of it, not getting distracted, not trying to be at too many conferences, not trying, you know, to do too much, not trying to be too fancy with your website, but focus on what you can do quickly and relatively cheaply without making it look cheap, of course, but then launch it and see if people use it.
You were there with Wider for 4 years, is that correct?
Yes.
What was the turning point there at the end? Like, how did you decide to move on or exit? What was the situation like there when it started to turn?
Yeah. So at the end, we closed it down. Wider was not the success we hoped for, even though we spent, three and a half, almost 4 years on it. We had a lot of artists, we had a lot of paintings, we had a lot of users, but not enough sales. So artists, paintings, and users, they grew exponentially, while the sales only grew linear. And that's why we decided at the end to stop it. We also had, like when we started in 2015, there were five competitors in US, in UK, and in Germany, and they got a multi-million funding back then. And we assumed they would create a market, that art can be digitalized and people start buying art online. That never happened. So three out of these five competitors closed shop already, and so did we at the end. We just couldn't convert enough users, even though there were a few hundred thousand of these users, couldn't convert many of them to customers.
Did you have sort of a couple of times during the 4 years where you sort of thought to yourself, okay, you know, should we pivot? Should we close it down? Or should we persevere, continue working on this? Just wondering, since, you know, after the 4 years, you decided to close it down. Maybe there was some sort of process in between as well.
Yeah, every day. That's always the challenge as a startup founder, to be open-minded and to pivot and to change the way once you realize that nobody needs it. But you also need to push through, because if you don't believe in your idea, why would anybody else? And that's always the fine line of you know, being strong and pushing through and being the idiot who doesn't want to realize it. And that together with a startup life is a roller coaster. You have the best day and the worst day of your life, and it's still Monday morning. And combining that, it is a tricky time. And so our process was that every few weeks we talked about it, because you're so deep in operations, in execution of stuff, that you sometimes forget the higher level. And we pushed ourselves at the beginning every few weeks, later on every few months, to take a step back and to talk about it. Yeah, so Matthias and me, the two founders, to really challenge ourselves. Is this still the right idea to execute? Are we doing it correctly? Should we change something? Do we have to pivot? So we pivot a few times, right? Not of course on the idea itself. So we are still doing on art, but the business model, the channels, how we attract the users, all that. Yeah, we changed that a few times.
Like, was there one moment, or was it just over a few weeks, or how did that come to be?
Yeah. So we were in the Silicon Valley. We got invited for a pitch competition as one of the top 100 startups around the world. And on the way back in the plane, that's when we made the decision. So even though we came back from a successful event, but we started to make the same experience again with Wider. We were always like 95, 99% there, but that last little thing was always missing. When you look at users, we had huge success with users, but not so much with the sales. We had huge success with investors because everybody wanted to talk with us. Everybody wanted to get more insights. Everybody loved what we were doing, but we never made it to the signature, right? And in so many aspects. And it was the same in the Silicon Valley. The pitch were fantastic. We had a great experience. We got to talk with so many people, but that was it, right? So on the plane back, it was sort of clear that we have to stop or really do a massive pivot. Right. And then it was still like it took us 6 months from that idea to actually close it down because there was still so much going on in between. And there are so many things, you know, these little screws you can tweak and want to fix it. There are still so many experiments you want to run and maybe can change something. And after investing 3 years of your time, you don't just want to close doors from one day to the other. So It took us another, yeah, I'm not sure, 5, 6, 7 months to actually make that step and close it down.
And during these 5, 6 months, I mean, what sort of steps do you have to close it down? I assume that, you know, you need to let the customers know, you need to both the artists and the users, as well as investors. I mean, what's the process there and what are the learnings that you can share with people?
Yeah, so the closing down is a process, but it's more happening in your head, right? So as a founder, especially if you're two or three founders, you have to discuss that through because there's money involved. There is a lot of time be invested in it. So you have to be sure that everybody is on the same page and is really what you want to do. Of course, also for users and artists, you have to inform them, ideally give them some alternatives and reasons. We got so many emails and messages why we're doing that. The product is great. You know, this is exactly the marketplace that was missing and would be missing again if we closed down. But yeah, that's why it was so difficult at the end. So with over 35,000 artists on the platform, with over 500,000 visitors, you know, there was something. Otherwise, that would have never happened. And that's, of course, the little hope. So what can we make out of it to keep providing value? Because if we close the shop, these 35,000 artists, they have nothing to share their paintings on. At the same time, it needs to be a business and not just a hobby. So it's a difficult situation at the end. I think open communication is the way to go, especially with the artists. They believed in you. They, you know, give you all of their paintings, invested in you in terms of time and that they gave you the paintings. And then open communication and open feedback is really important there.
I mean, also one thing about this is like, I mean, for you and your founder, Matthias, it must have been quite an emotional experience as well to close down such a company you worked on for 4 years. You put your heart into it. Your family might have also been affected. I mean, how do you handle that as a founder?
Yeah, and that's the most difficult situation, right? To after such a long time to finally accept that you built something nobody wants, or nobody wants to pay for at least. Yeah, it is a tough decision. And that's why it took us so long at the end. Also, that in combination with the positive feedback we get from artists, from users, from buyers, yeah, it makes the decision hard. And you want to look for new experiments. What is the next thing you can still try? Maybe there is just this little thing you have to change and, you know, that the business will fly. But yeah, there are only so many screws you can take. And then after doing that for a few months where you just look for this little loophole, then also the motivation is gone. Because you try and you try and you try and the numbers improve, but not constantly. You don't really know what's happening. So then also the motivation goes down and that's the point you have to stop.
So what are some of the main takeaways you want some of the listeners to learn from your story? Maybe you haven't explicitly said it already.
Sure. So important is that you start. Right. There's so many fantastic startup ideas in all our heads and only a few of us actually start doing something. And without Startup Weekend, I would be the same where we just had a university project and we had some nice ideas, but that's it. Mm-hmm. And really execute on the idea. Start talking with customers or with people. Yeah, at the beginning, they're not customers. Start talking with people, start observing them like I did at IKEA and getting involved. Get involved with your local startup community. Everybody else, everybody out there is so helpful. It's easy to find mentors. It's easy to find role models, to find inspiration, but then actually do it. And as I said at the beginning, you don't have to quit your job to do it. Do it on the evenings or on the weekends. And once you get some sort of traction, then you know that you have to move on. So yeah, sounds easy, but the hardest part is actually to start.
I think that's also interesting that you're coming from such a corporate background before and making such a jump into the startup world. I mean, are there any sort of, I don't know, learnings or, I don't know, something you want to share with people that are, let's say, working in the corporate world and, you know, want to take that step?
Yeah, it's important to share your idea, right? I'm now also organizer of several meetups and events, and I often get people, they don't want to tell me their idea. They say they have this fantastic idea. They just need, you know, $1 million and three marketing people and three developers, and they're the next Facebook, which of course never happens. So how would you find customers if you don't tell what your idea is? Mm-hmm. So talk about it, you know, be coachable, get feedback, use it to build a better product, not keep the idea in your mind, dreaming about it. So it's really the execution, which already starts at talking about it. And I see a lot of corporate people behaving like this. They're used to that, right? Because companies are used to, like, they're supposed to know what they're doing. They're experts in their field. So they are supposed to know what the customers want, what are they building, how it should look like at the end. And as a startup, you have to admit that you don't know anything. You don't know what you're building, you don't know for whom, and you don't know really why. And admitting that is a big relief. Right? And then you can start experimenting, you can start talking with people, and you're open for that feedback. So that's, especially for corporate people, a big change in mindset.
Did you buy any art pieces through the app? What were some of your favorite pieces?
I did at the very end. So at the beginning, I promised my wife not to do it because it would get quite expensive after a while. We did have some really, really good artworks on the platform. You wouldn't expect when we call them amateur and independent artists, but they do fantastic work. And I also bought 5 paintings. I'm more of a abstract and modern art kind of guy. And that's what I have in my living room now.
So, Timo, what quote did you bring with you today?
Yeah, I have a quote which I always live by. If you always do what you have always done, you will always get what you have always got. It's a quote they assigned to Einstein or to Henry Ford. Nobody knows who said it. Maybe it was somebody very different, but it doesn't matter. So it's a quote I live by, like, constant change, right? The world doesn't stand still, and so shouldn't you. Yeah, embrace the change, get out of your comfort zone, try out new things, and grow with it. So that's really something I live by for many years now already.
That's a good one. Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. Being our first guest, I really appreciated hearing your story. I learned lots definitely from your experience, and I'm sure other people will too. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Lots of fun for me as well.
Where can people connect with you online or support you? What's going on?
So I'm on the typical social media channels, LinkedIn, Facebook, you will find me, but also on the timohan.com, trying to share some more learnings.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
When I was researching Wider, I came across this Indian company with the same name. You probably heard of it. It actually had funding around the same time as you guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, how did you guys come up with that name, and what's the story behind that?
So, funny enough, when we came up with the name, we were in India. And we never know if, you know, somebody on the other table listened to us and started a company in India. Probably not, but it was quite funny that we started Wider, and then a few months later a company in India did the same thing. They are more like an Alibaba in India, so very different business model, just the same name. So the name was just, you know, a fun night out with too much alcohol, and afterwards we came up with a meaning. So Wider stands for making the art world wider. It's apparently okay. It's very limited on the galleries and the fine art, and we want to make it wider, expand it. But I have to admit, alcohol and the fun night out came first.
Revisionist history there.
Thanks so much for listening today and for making it to the end of the episode. I hope you learned something. Our theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send in your guest recommendations, drop us a line at lunch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Alex or myself on LinkedIn. Otherwise, have a great week and we'll see you next time on Launch and Learn.